Right now we have a real treat, folks, okay? Each and every Wednesday at 4:20, we're going to be getting an education beyond belief. We're going to start right from the beginning of money in the USA. And in the USA. Our guest, Dr. Edward Vieira Jr., holds four degrees from Harvard, okay, right from A to Z, okay, Harvard Law School, constitutional lawyer. That's what he specializes in. He's been in front of the Supreme Court, with some landmark decisions. And he's written many articles, a couple unbelievable books. The one we're going to be discussing is Pieces of Eight, The Monetary Powers and Disabilities of the United States Constitution. Edward Vieira, welcome to Attack of Financial News. How are you doing?
It's my pleasure, Tom.
Hey, thank you so much for doing this, too. This is absolutely going to be fabulous. We're really psyched. And, I was, the last couple of days, I was telling folks you're going to come on. And people, it's a great process that we're going to get educated here. Let me ask you, you get the monetary powers and disabilities of the United States Constitution. The disabilities of the Constitution, right? How did you come up with the name of the book?
That's actually a technical term. Oh. In legal parlance, we have rights, powers, immunities, disabilities. You can go on. There's a list of these terms.
Nice.
I think everyone's familiar with what a right is, with what a privilege is,
yes,
with what a power is. Power is something that the government can do to you in terms of passing a law,
right,
creating a regulation, deciding a judicial decision. A disability is the opposite of a power. It's something that the government cannot do. It's the absence of a power. And the Constitution, I think as everyone is aware, was designed to start essentially from scratch in terms of defining the powers of Congress, the President, and the court system. The powers that are not there in the Constitution are, technically speaking, the government's disabilities. It's the things that it cannot do. That's the essence of a limited government. The government can go only so far, and beyond a certain point in certain areas, it has a disability. And for the monetary area, it's particularly important because the disabilities really define the ambit of freedom that the rest of us have,
yes,
face-to-face with the government in terms of what the government can't do to us. So I think it's fundamentally important, and that's the reason that point was put in there, that I wasn't talking simply about what the government can do, but perhaps even more importantly, what it cannot do.
Yeah, huge point. And I can tell you, folks, if you go to TFNN and you go to the contributors page, both of his books are right there. You can order both books. It's, one's Crashmaker, A Federal Affair, which is a novel that he did with Victor Spiridenko, and the second one is Pieces of Eight. The Pieces of Eight, folks, bar none, okay, is an encyclopedia. It's two volumes of basically 1,600 pages each, but I got to tell you something. I'm only up to about 150 pages of the first volume right now, but it is unbelievable. And I can tell you, Ed, when the disabilities alone really got me going because it makes things really clear. Why did you write the book?
I started many years ago being interested in this subject because I was somewhat self-taught in economics. And as soon as you start reading about economics, of course, you get into the central role of money in the entire system.
Yeah.
Our modern price structure depends upon money. We have a transactions-based economy as opposed to a barter economy. So money is fundamental. And you don't go very far in talking about money, even in an economic textbook, without bringing into play the role of government.
Yeah.
Government has always, throughout history, has had an important role to play with respect to money. So that leads me directly into the legal area. And then when I began studying law, this was one of those topics that you see coming up in constitutional law very early on. It comes up, of course, in the Constitutional Convention where the Founding Fathers designed the Constitution. It comes up in some of the earliest Supreme Court decisions, and it was important thereafter. It's in the Civil War, 1930s, so forth and so on. So I began studying that essentially as a hobby. And then in the early 1980s, I came into contact with a man by the name of Richard Solium, to whom Pieces of Eight is dedicated. He's now passed his rewards.
Yes.
And he is what I would call a self-taught Federal Reserve and money gold bug, if you will.
Okay.
He was very interested in those areas. And he wanted to bring some kind of a test case that would raise some of the fundamental constitutional issues dealing with money. And that was the spark that set off a little fire. And I began pulling together all this material that I had been collecting in a sort of hobby form over the years for his case, which in fact is described in the book Pieces of Eight. And at the same time that that was happening, there was in Congress a body called the United States Gold Commission that had been established for the purpose of looking into the possibility of doing something with the restoration of gold in the American monetary system.
Okay.
Ron Paul was one of the members
of
that commission. They didn't do much, as it turned out, not specifically because of anything that he did or didn't do, but it was one of those things that was more or less window dressing and a sort of a dog and pony show. They had some witnesses, and they really didn't come out with anything that was of great value in the long run. But one day in his office, when I was talking to some of his legislative people, I asked them sort of offhandedly, well, what did the commission have in front of it that dealt with this question, the powers and disabilities of the Constitution with respect to money?
Which never, no one ever thinks about the disabilities, do they?
No. That word is kind of a foreign word in the average person's discourse.
Yes, it is.
Although it's a legal term of art, it's well known in that area, but the average person doesn't think about that. Well, the strange answer that I received from them was, well, essentially nothing's been put in. And I said, oh my goodness, how can you be discussing the role of Congress with respect to money without having these basic principles in front of the commission? So they said, well, all right, if that's the case, you write something. So I did. I wrote maybe it was 100 pages long, typewritten thing that was submitted. And as I said, the commission went essentially nowhere. But Ron Paul's people suggested to me that I publish that little study. It was called The Monetary Powers and Disabilities in the United States Constitution.
Okay.
And I upgraded that and put in a little more history, some things that hadn't been of interest to the commission but would have been to readers. And I published the first volume of Pieces of Eight in 1983 with the assistance of Richard Sawyer.
Unreal. That was way ahead of, I mean, that's a long time ago.
That's right. We've been at this a long time, and we published that in a paperback format. It was about 300 pages long, a self-generated book.
Yes.
It took us a number of years to sell the couple thousand copies that we produced, 2,000 to 3,000 copies that we produced. And it became something of a cult classic, if you know what I mean.
Absolutely.
There were certain people that bought that book. This was wonderful. It had material they hadn't seen anywhere else. And over the years, people kept coming to me and said, well, when are you going to, you know, reprint this or republish this? And finally, I realized there was enough interest in the subject to warrant really doing something. And so I upgraded it from 380 pages to 1,700 pages, covering not only the coinage and paper money, but the history of the various banking arrangements here in the United States, to make it as complete as I could in something that could at least be carried. It's two volumes and it's fairly weighty, but it's the kind of thing that you can keep in a small library, not be overwhelmed.
Oh, folks, it's absolutely fabulous, too. I mean, I it's wild. I have one volume in the office, and I have one at home. Really? I mean, that's, you know, because I'm looking at, because what the context of it, folks, is just phenomenal. And we're going to go through this context so you can see how the Fed theory develops and how Edward Vieira is basically having a theory here that says, okay, you know, here's the Constitution, and what is it? Let's start with the dollar.
Yes, sir.
What is the dollar? It's a great word, but what is it actually in physical means?
Well, that actually is the key to the whole study. If one goes back to the Constitution, which is obviously the best place to start when you're studying the powers of Congress and its disabilities,
yes,
you'll find the word dollar used twice. Used once in what was called the slave tax provision, the provision of the Constitution that set a maximum of $10 per head for people who were imported into the United States. That was the euphemism they used for slaves.
Unbelievable. Okay.
And it also appears in the Seventh Amendment, jury trial for any claim of value greater than $20. Now, you have to remember that those two provisions of the Constitution were very important at the time, because the southern states, which were the slaveholding states primarily, although there was some slaveholding in essentially every state at that time, the southern states would never have agreed to a provision in the Constitution dealing with the importation of slaves and the taxation on that unless they had known what the word dollar meant.
Yes.
Similarly, the Seventh Amendment was part of the Bill of Rights. That was put in by the people who were called the Anti-Federalists, the ones who were very leery and suspicious of a central government. And they wanted to be sure that the fundamental rights of Englishmen, and Americans, for that matter, we were all derived from the English system, that those fundamental rights were clearly protected. That was the quid pro quo. They said, yes, we'll go along with the ratification of this Constitution, but as soon as it's ratified, we want a Bill of Rights put in as amendments to clarify the position of these fundamental liberties. And jury trial, of course, is one of the most important of those rights.
Yes.
You think those people knew what $20 meant?
Absolutely.
All right. Now, you don't find the word defined in the Constitution. You don't find very many words defined in the Constitution at all. That's because it was well known at that time what a dollar was. You go back to the discussions in the Continental Congress, which was the Congress under the Articles of Confederation that preceded the Constitution during the War of Independence.
Yes.
They adopted a monetary system. Actually, it was Thomas Jefferson who was the architect, if you will, of the monetary system. And he proposed that the Spanish milled dollar, the silver Spanish milled dollar, be adopted as the unit of American United States currency, because that was the money that was, for all intents and purposes, the real standard of value in the marketplace.
Okay.
And it had been.
Right.
For a very long time. You can go back to the earliest document I found official law promulgating that was in 1704, when Queen Anne and then her parliament in 1707 passed a proclamation and then a statute that made the Spanish milled dollar the standard of all the foreign silver coins that we used in the American colonies. And the reason for that, of course, was that there was a terrific trade going on between the colonies on the one hand and all of the Spanish possessions in the Caribbean and South America on the other hand.
Okay.
And those Spanish possessions operated primarily on a silver standard based upon the dollar. And that dollar was minted in Mexico, it was minted in Peru, some of them were minted in Spain. So it was what was being used by merchants at the time. Jefferson wasn't inventing something new. He was looking into the marketplace and saying, let's take what's out there
exactly,
and what the market has adopted, and let's apply that and put that into our fundamental law and make that the basis of the monetary system.
Right.
Now, just one aside here, if you go back a long way, the dollar actually originated in a coin called the Thaler, T-H-A-L-E-R, in Bavaria. At a time when Spain and Austria were ruled by the same royal house, the House of Habsburg. So actually, the genealogy of the thing traces back into Bavaria. In the 1490s, Isabella and Ferdinand, the same folks who sent Columbus to the New World,
yes,
they adopted a new Spanish monetary system based on a coin called the real, the royal. And there were 8 reals in a Spanish milled dollar. And that's the reason it was called the Piece of 8. Now you see where the title came
from. Absolutely.
The dollar was originally called, or the dollar was known in jargon as a piece of 8 because each dollar contained 8 reales.
Wow.
And in fact, in those early days, to make change, because there wasn't a lot of coinage floating around, people would literally cut dollars into 2 pieces, 4 pieces, 6 pieces, 8 pieces to make change. And 2 reales, the colloquialism for a real was a bit.
Okay.
2 bits was a quarter.
Oh, sure, that's where they got 2 bits.
And why were the prices on the New York Stock Exchange, or the Stock Exchange, quoted in eighths, quarters, etc.? Because they were based upon the dollar, which was divisible by 8.
Wow, that's wild.
Take you all the way back. Now remember, just one little other vignette here. Remember Treasure Island?
Yes.
Long John Silver's parrot.
Oh, yeah.
Captain Flint. What did Captain Flint always say? Pieces of eight.
That's right.
Because the pirates that preyed on the Spanish treasure ships in the Caribbean were looking for, among the loot that they took, of course, were chests full of these coins.
Exactly.
The piece of eight. So there's the genealogy of the thing. It goes back to the Spanish system through the English trade, through the colonies in South America and primarily Central America, up to the time of the Continental Congress during the War of Independence. Thomas Jefferson, one of the great geniuses, if you will, among the founding fathers, comes up with this plan to adopt the dollar as the unit, and then gold coinage also in a what I would call an equivalent role, because he foresaw that both silver and gold would circulate.
Sure.
That was, in fact, adopted by the Continental Congress. So when all of these founding fathers, many of whom had sat in the Continental Congress, joined together in the Federal Convention to write the Constitution, it was certainly second nature for them to put the word dollar into the Constitution because,
right,
as they well knew, this thing, the dollar, had already been adopted by the earlier Congress as the unit of American money.
And they knew what the value was. And
that's right. They knew what the value was.
Exactly. And, folks, the Seventh Amendment, okay, this is what it says. In suits at common law where the value in controversy shall exceed $20, the right of a trial by jury shall be preserved. And no fact tried by the jury shall be otherwise re-examined by any court in the United States than according to the rules of common law. That's incredible. Okay, so we start, so now we know what the dollar is.
That's right.
Now,
and you see how simple it was.
It is, absolutely.
You see, this is not something that requires one to have a PhD in history.
Right.
Right.
Well, you had to go back quite a way, though, didn't you?
Well, I had to look some of these things up, but for instance, the journals of the Continental Congress, there are about 20-something volumes of those. They're all available, and they recount everything the Continental Congress did. And you can find very quickly what I've just described about the adoption of the dollar and Jefferson's role and so forth. It's all right there.
That's all. Can you just hang with us just for a second?
Sure.
Oh, this is great. Okay. Listen, folks, this is Tom O'Brien. This is Edward Vieira. And, folks, you can get his book right on our website. It's actually I'm going to direct you to his website. But you just go to TFNN, you go to Contributors, you'll see his bio right there, and you'll be able to check this out. We're going to get a great education here, folks. It's probably going to take a couple of years, but you know what? It's a beautiful thing. He's been out there, you know, for 23, 30 years here doing it, and he's going to be right in front of us and giving us great education. This is Tom O'Brien. We have the Dow Industrials close up 30, the NASDAQ up 14, the S&P's up 8. We're going to be right back, folks.
Would you like to become a better technical trader? Jim Ord and Tom O'Brien are heading west to Denver, Colorado, July 26th with their highly acclaimed workshop, Timing the Trade. This workshop is designed to teach a range of traders from beginner to experienced with all the tools you need to be successful in the market. Topics will include candlestick charting, price projection, expansion, and contraction theory using Fibonacci. You will learn how to act and react at swing points in the market using volume. They will go over cause, volume, effect, price, ABCs, and how to put it all together to help you better understand how the market moves. You also get Tom O'Brien's 5.5-hour video, Trading with Confidence and Confluence. This video, valued at $238, will be sent to you free of charge when you sign up for the Timing the Trade workshop so that you can become better prepared while you wait. The last two seminars sold out, and we expect this one will also. The total cost of the seminar is only $395 through May 11th. Call today and reserve your spot while seats are still available. Call 877-518-9190 or visit tfnn.com.
Tom O'Brien's hot-selling book, Timing the Trade, has helped thousands of traders across the world, and it can help you, too.
I just got the book, I'd say, 2 or 3 weeks ago, and I love it. Hey, I mean, I'm an absolute novice at all this. It sheds a lot of light on so many different areas that really make what seems so complicated a lot simpler. When you can make it visual like that, it makes it so much easier to understand.
For just $88, you can become familiar with each of Tom's trading tools and techniques and be on your way to becoming a better trader.
Well, mate, I've got your book out of dying. It's fantastic. I just started to get into it, so
okay.
And I want to tell everyone how comprehensive it is.
Oh, thank you, man.
And you know, for the money, it's just an absolute steal.
Included in the price, you'll get a CD-ROM and information about Fibonacci trading, volume indicators, candlestick charting, and much more. To order Tom's book today, call 877-518-9190, 877-518-9190, or log on to tfnn.com.
Are you frustrated, always wondering what to do with the market today? Well, the market continues to tumble downward. Tom O'Brien has helped his subscribers consistently make money on their investments with his Let's Eliminate the Brain Damage newsletter. Every morning at the opening, Tom gives you his daily take on the market along with his pick of stocks, options, and indices. Tom tells you when to buy, when to sell, and what prices to use for your stops and targets. Nothing is left to guess. With Tom's daily newsletter, you can forget about those restless nights left wondering if the decisions you made were the right ones. Tom makes it simple and easy with all the information you need to trade without the brain damage. At a cost of $79 per month, the newsletter can pay for itself in no time. Tom uses his own trading tools and techniques that he has developed and fine-tuned over the years to help you manage your portfolio better. Call today and take the guessing game out of trading forever. Call 877-518-9190, 877-518-9190, or visit tfnn.com. What could you possibly be waiting for?
If you'd like the convenience of hearing Tom O'Brien on your local radio station to listen at home, at work, and in the car, then call your local radio station. Tell them it's easier than ever to broadcast the Tom O'Brien Show, now distributed via satellite every day. When they contact TFNN, we'll give them all the information. And thanks.
Okay, folks, welcome back to Tom O'Brien from Tiger Finesse News. Our guest today, folks, okay, every Wednesday, 4:20, is going to be Dr. Edwin Vieira Jr. Bottom line is that he has a couple of phenomenal books out. The one we're discussing right now is Pieces of Eight, The Monetary Powers and Disabilities of the United States Constitution. You can get that, folks. You go over to TFNN, go to contributor page. You'll see his bio. You can get right on his website. And I can tell you flat out, folks, he's selling it for $49. It's a labor of love, okay? This is two volumes. There's no way it's just unbelievable. That's the real bottom line. It really is, and we really appreciate what you're doing for everyone out there. Let me ask you something. Okay, so we know we have the value of the dollar.
Right.
What the constitutional value of the dollar is. So how did we go from what the constitutional value of the dollar is to what the dollar is, well, we don't want to go to present day, but even, 30 years, 40 years later, 50 years later, as to what the dollar is either worth or what is inside the dollar.
Well, let's understand the first thing. Constitutionally speaking, the dollar has never changed.
Okay.
We've had some manipulations by various Congresses and then ultimately the Congress in league with the Treasury and the banking system, of course.
Yes.
So that we have various instruments floating out there that are denominated in dollars. I mean, you take a Federal Reserve note today, your George Washington will have the inscription, $1. Is it a dollar? No. It's a Federal Reserve note. It's a promise to pay a dollar. There's a statute that talks about redemption of Federal Reserve notes in lawful money.
Right, you see,
it's not the same thing at all.
Right.
So there's the first thing. We have to be very careful in the use of words.
Absolutely.
Now, if you go back historically to the original Treasury bill, which was the Coinage Act of 1792, was passed by the Second Congress of the United States, many of whose members had been among the group we call the Founding Fathers who were in the Constitutional Convention, so they knew whereof they spoke. And they said in that bill that the new United States dollar shall be of the value of the Spanish mill dollar as the same as now current, and to contain 371 and 1/4 grains of silver. Now, what do they mean by that? The word value used in the Constitution refers to what economists call the intrinsic value of a coin, that is, how much gold or how much silver does it actually contain.
Okay.
Not what its purchasing power in the market may be,
right.
Not how many pounds of beans it may buy, but how much metal does it contain.
Yes.
That's the way they use that word value. You can trace that all the way back to English law. So when they were talking about the value of the new United States dollar, they were talking about its weight in silver, and they said, it shall be of the value of the Spanish mill dollar as the same is now current. Now, that word current means running, circulating, in the marketplace. And what they did, both under the Continental Congress and then the Treasury when the Constitution had come in, Alexander Hamilton was Secretary of the Treasury, they went out to the marketplace and they did what we would call statistical analysis. They pulled in a sample of the Spanish mill dollars that were actually circulating. Some were from Mexico, some were from Peru, whatever. Some were less worn, some were more worn. But the ones that were circulating, they melted them down, they found out how much silver that melt contained, they divided it by the number of coins, I think they took 1,000 coins, they divided it by the number of coins, and they came up with a statistical sample of what a good circulating Spanish mill dollar contained, again, in the marketplace, not in somebody's mind, not what it ought to be,
yes,
but what it really was at the time. And they said, that's it, that's what the market calls a dollar, that's what the Constitution means by the word dollar, here it is in the Coinage Act of 1792. And I might point out that that was an act, you go look up the legislative history, the debates in Congress, you find essentially no debate at all on that. The only debate was whether they wanted to put on the face of the coin the head of some, American dignitary. And they said, oh no, we don't want to do that. We don't want a king's head on this thing, if you know what I mean.
Right, absolutely.
We don't want that. It's a republic, not a monarchy. There was no debate about the substance because they all knew what the substance was. That was one of the few areas. Jefferson was then Secretary of State. Hamilton was Secretary of the Treasury. It was one of the few areas in which those two men completely agreed. So that was 1792. Silver dollar contains a pleonism. The dollar is silver. The dollar contains 371 and a quarter grains of silver. They also set up a set of gold coins. And they didn't call those gold coins dollars. They called them eagles.
I got it. Okay.
Why do they call them eagles?
I don't know.
Because they weren't dollars.
Because
Because
they needed another name.
Oh, that's awesome.
Right?
I love it. Oh,
they needed another name.
Unbelievable.
Right? They couldn't call them Dallas.
Yes.
And then they said, the value of the eagle shall be such and such dollars. Now, how did they value the eagle? Well, they went to the marketplace, and they took what they thought was the exchange value between silver and gold, and they put in, that was 15 to 1, and they put in the gold coin, the amount of gold that exchanged against a silver dollar, actually 10 times the amount, because the eagle was, there was $10 coin, $20, $20 coin, and so forth. So they were working entirely on a market-based exchange ratio. That's the original system, and that system actually continued unchanged until the Civil War. And at the Civil War, you have the first, essentially, break point. During that whole period of time, from, let's say, 1792, the first coinage act, until 1862, the government of the United States had generated no paper money whatsoever.
Okay.
Neither had the state governments. There were private banks out there that had been given corporate charters by the states, or in two instances, corporate charters by the United States, two famous instances, the first and second bank of the United States. But they were private entities, and
right.
They were generating private banknotes. But the governments generated no paper money. And there was a very good reason for that. The disabilities. Article 1, Section 10, Clause 1 of the Constitution says, no state shall emit bills of credit. Bills of credit was the term that was used for paper money in the early days. Why? Because they understood that paper money was a note. It was a promise to pay.
Exactly.
Right? It was a bill of credit. Someone had promised to do something
right.
In terms of paying over, in that case, money, real money being coinage. Now, Congress, let me go back one step. That provision, no state shall emit bills of credit, had to be there because the states, once they became independent, had generated bills of credit on the basis of their claim that they had the power to do so.
I see.
So the only way to stop them from doing that was to put a specific provision in the Constitution creating a disability for the states, and that's why that's there.
I see.
Congress, though, remember, Congress had no power at all prior to the Constitution having been ratified. Congress is a creature of the Constitution. You don't find any provision in the Constitution granting Congress power to emit paper money or to emit bills of credit. Why? There was a draft of the Constitution that included the words, Congress shall have the power to borrow money and emit bills on the credit of the United States. In other words, during the Constitutional Convention, someone had proposed that Congress should have that power because the Continental Congress, in fact, had had that power, the power to borrow money and emit bills.
Right.
And the Continental Congress had used that power to generate a very famous form of paper money, which was called...
The Continental.
The Continental,
exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
And the Continental had gone to hell in a handbasket
right.
during the War of Independence until it was not worth a Continental. Remember that famous phrase?
Totally, absolutely.
All right. So the first draft of the Constitution took that provision out of the Articles of Confederation and used it. And then there was a debate. And the debate on that particular provision was rather vehement. Because all of the Founding Fathers were perfectly well aware of what had happened during the War of Independence. They had been there, right?
Yes.
So they struck those words, and emit bills. Follow this. There was a proposal to give Congress the power to generate paper money, and it was struck from the draft.
Okay, exactly.
All right, end of discussion, right?
Yes.
Therefore, one would conclude, because Congress has only the powers that were actually given to it, with respect to paper money, it must have not a power, but a... disability.
Exactly.
Right, because they took it away. All right. So everyone understood that in this country up until 1862. Now, 1862, of course, Civil War had started in 1861. And the Union government essentially had a panic within the upper circles, especially in the Treasury Department, Congress, as to how they were going to raise money. The banks had suspended CC payments, that is essentially they declared bankruptcy.
Yes.
They were demanding huge interest, 7% they wanted in those days for war loans. Can you imagine that? That's what they considered huge interest rates.
Unreal.
In those days. But that was very high.
Sure.
At that time.
Absolutely.
So the Union Congress, of course, was worried because the whole thing could have fallen apart if a couple of other states had seceded, if Maryland had gone and so forth. And so on. Who knew what would be the fate of the Union? So Salmon T. Chase, who was Secretary of the Treasury, he was very worried about raising taxes too quickly because he didn't want to alienate a lot of people.
So he proposed the creation of United States notes that would circulate as money with legal tender character. And these became known as the greenbacks, for the reason that they were printed in green ink.
Okay.
Which, of course, is the tradition ever since, right?
Yes.
All the way up to the Federal Reserve note printed in green ink. That was the first time that the government had ever generated paper currency, and it was done under what they considered to be the press of this emergency because of the necessity of financing the Union side of the Civil War. Actually, the Confederate government did the same thing, so we can't give them much more credit than the Union government.
Right.
They both generated paper money, but it was 1862. Now, one of the things that you learn very early on in constitutional analysis is you can't take something that Congress has done and necessarily impute that to the Constitution, that is, say that, oh, because Congress did it, it must be constitutional. Unless you're talking about something that it was one of the first or second Congresses to do.
Okay.
Because, of course, those people, the first and second Congresses, maybe the third Congress, those people were part of the group we call the Founding Fathers.
Yes.
They probably knew as much as anyone what the Constitution really meant because they had written the bloody thing, right?
Yes.
When you get 70 years later, especially under the emergency conditions of a war and the panic situation that arose, you can't really give much credit to the Congress of the Civil War period as thinking clearly or worrying too much about what the Constitution meant. But there you have it. It took all that period of time for this paper money to be generated.
And, you know, let me ask you, this is phenomenal, actually, because, and folks, where we're going with this, okay, is, as he's explaining, that, okay, you know, they came out during the Civil War, they decided that, okay, we're gonna print these notes, but one of the quotes in his book is absolutely phenomenal, that an unconstitutional act is not a law, it confers no rights, it imposes no duties, it is an illegal complication, inoperative as though it's never been passed. And is that one of the bases that we're talking about here?
Oh, absolutely. The fundamental thing one has to realize about a Constitution is, once again, the powers and disabilities. If they act, that Congress, the President, whomever, if a public official acts consistently with the Constitution, we have no problem. If he acts inconsistently with the Constitution, he has no more authority than you or I do.
It's a beautiful thing. Listen,
right.
This is going to be a great... What's going to happen here, folks, okay? Wednesday, 4:20, don't forget it, okay? We're going to be going through this, and we're going to start off with the Civil War next week. We're going to get into private parties. Why, you know, if private parties are generating paper, why should the government reserve any liability? And I want to get into the living Constitution. I love
right.
how you talk about that living Constitution.
Very important.
It is unbelievable. Listen, folks, you can get the book. Go to TFNN. Go to the contributor page. You'll see Dr. Edward Vieira right there. Jump over there and order Pieces of Eight right now. It's $49, folks. And I got to tell you something. This is a book not only you'll have forever, but, I mean, if you are interested in, number one, what your rights are all about and what history is all about and what really brought this great country here and get it back onto an honest money system, it's a phenomenal book, and it's laid out, and you just heard the man, though. I mean, and listen, I want to thank you so much, because this is, it's so important, it's unbelievable. You know what I love? I can't believe that the Eagles are a different, you know, you get the Dollars and you get the Eagles. Seriously, I mean, it makes a lot of sense.
You see how they understood it. You see how simple it is when you go back and look at it from their perspective.
When you bring it from the start. Well, you know what I've seen
right.
in life too a lot, there's no doubt about it, you know, is that you can see how words change dramatically. And, you know, if you go back to the source, it makes a big difference. There's no doubt about it.
Absolutely.
Listen, thank you so much. I really look forward to talking to you next week, too.
Talk to you, Tom. Thanks.
Absolutely. Have a great one. That's Dr. Edward Vieira, Jr., folks, okay? Constitutional lawyer, holds four, degrees from Harvard, including Harvard Law. And we are going to get an education of a lifetime. And I can tell you, folks, this book is just absolutely... We're going to do this on the air. We'll go for a year. We'll go for 2 years. We'll go for... he's going to stay on forever, hopefully, anyway. But we're going to walk all the way through this. But you can check out the book right at TFNN.com. Want to thank him. Want to thank all the listeners out there. And we're cooking, folks. We're growling and prowling. We had the Dow Industrials close up by 30. The NASDAQ was up 14. The S&P was up 8 points.
To the Tom O'Brien Show.
Hey, folks, welcome back. This is Tom O'Brien. This is Saga Finance Network. And if your money can talk, folks, as Dr. Nathan Vieira, author of Pieces of Eight and Crashmaker, it would tell you that what is a dollar? Is it a Spanish mill dollar? What is a dollar? What is a dollar all about? Want to welcome back Edward Vieira to Tiger Financial News. Each and every Wednesday, 4:20, this time, folks, okay, this program is archived. You can get it 24 hours a day. He's given us an education of a lifetime on the monetary powers and disabilities of the United States Constitution. Edward, how you doing?
Oh, glad to be back, Tom.
Absolutely. You have a good week?
Oh, sure.
Awesome, man. Awesome. So we when we finished, we were finishing off at the Civil War.
Right.
So what I'd love to do is basically start at the Civil War. You know, as to, you know, what has, you know, basically going forward, what happened to our money?
Well, let's go back one step from the Civil War and recognize that during the period from the founding of the country and the ratification of the Constitution up until the Civil War, you had essentially two kinds of media of exchange in the marketplace.
Okay.
You had the official money, constitutional money, which was silver coin or gold coin. And then you had paper notes that were generated by various private banks.
Okay.
And most of those banks, or many of those banks, were chartered in some way by a government. You had corporations that were chartered, for instance, by Congress. Now, those banks generated bank notes, and the bank notes were redeemable in official money, gold and silver coin. And this was the beginning of the problem, because, of course, as long as those bank notes were, in fact, redeemable, as long as the banks were solvent and liquid, those notes circulated in the marketplace as if they were money.
Right, it was a promise to actually get gold or silver. Right.
Right, and you could go back to the banks, the holders of those notes could go back to the banks if they wanted to, and redeem them for actual specie coinage. But the problem that crept into that system was the fractional reserve process, by which the banks would generate more paper notes, more promises to redeem, than they actually had silver or gold coin in their vaults. And they were able to do this because they noticed that those notes, as long as the banks maintained a certain reputation for redemption, those notes would tend to circulate and not come back for redemption.
Right.
So they could afford to generate more notes than they had reserves, and of course by generating more notes they could make more loans, and by making more loans they could make more interest payments, and therefore it was good business for the banks in principle. Of course it was bad business for the economy, because to the extent the banks overextended themselves, and they did on a relatively periodic basis during that pre-Civil War period, you had what they called panics. We would call them depressions or recessions. And they were generally manifested in the failure of banks to redeem because the banks had too much of their capital lent out and not enough on reserve.
Yes.
And you would have these periods of what they call bank stringencies, bank collapses, failures of the banks to pay out. And it created all sorts of economic difficulties, these periodic panics. So those were the two. And regulate and police that banking practice of fractional reserve generation of notes.
And folks, just so you understand fractional reserve, what happens with a fractional reserve is that even at this particular point, if the Fed, if a bank gets $100 in, well, instead, you know, if you keep it for a year and a half, they can lend out $1,000. So it's almost a 10-to-1 deal, okay? So you can see what happens here on a fractional reserve basis.
That's right. So essentially the system has not changed, except now we don't have redemption any longer in silver or gold. But that was the pre-Civil War problem. And what it did was to create in the mindset of people the idea that these paper notes were the equivalent of real money, of the official constitutional money. Now comes the Civil War,
yeah,
and the Union Congress had a problem, which was that the war, to a certain extent, was unpopular. Taxation was something that the Treasury didn't want to indulge in if it could avoid it. And the banks were charging, at that time, what were considered very high rates of interest for loans, 7%, if you can believe it.
Wow.
Considered the Civil War period, very high rate of interest for loans. And the banks had also suspended their specie payments. They were now refusing to redeem their paper notes because they had found themselves in this position of stringency because the whole economy was in chaos because of the war. So along comes Salmon P. Chase, the Secretary of the Treasury, and he says, well, what we need to do is to generate federal government paper currency, United States notes.
Okay.
And these notes will have a legal tender character attached to them, which means that everyone must accept them in payment of dollar-denominated debts. And this was, it happened in 1862, February the 28th, 1862. And this was the first time since the Constitution had come into play that the national government, Congress, was authorizing the generation of a paper currency. And the time before that had been, of course, the continental currency under the old Continental Congress. And that, of course, had broken down during the War of Independence. So here we've gone through a period of about 70-some years in which the country had functioned under the Constitution, the only official money being gold and silver coin. And then comes the crisis of the Civil War, and the Union government puts in this legal tender greenback legislation. They call those things the greenbacks because they were printed with green ink. Well, I don't want to blame the Union Congress, but of course the Confederates do the same thing.
Right.
Confederates generated paper money, and we all know the joke about Confederate dollars and what they turned out to be worth. So both sides in the Civil War were caught in the same economic stringency, and they both reverted to a paper money scheme. But here was the question. Was this going to be upheld as constitutional? And in fact, there was quite a debate over that, both in Congress and outside of Congress. Finally came to the Supreme Court after the Civil War, 1871, the so-called legal tender cases, the Knox versus Lee case, Parker versus Davis case. And the Supreme Court, 5-4 decision, upheld the constitutionality of these notes based on a theory that, well, this wasn't the generation of money per se. The real money was still the silver and gold coin that the Treasury minted. But this was an attempt by Congress to essentially anticipate a loan. This was a forced loan on the country because you could take these notes and you could purchase U.S. bonds with them, and the interest of the bonds was paid in gold coin, or eventually the notes were going to be redeemed. In fact, they were redeemed again in 1875. So that principle slipped into the law, the concept that the national government could generate paper currency that was legal tender. Now, I should point out the Knox case made it very clear that in the Supreme Court's view, now, of course, they were wrong on the merits of the situation. There's no justification for Congress generating paper currency. But the principle that they upheld was that the paper currency would be redeemable in silver or gold. All right? Yes, it was redeemable in nothing. They were talking about U.S. notes generated by the Treasury, which would be redeemed in the official silver or gold coinage of the country.
Right.
And it was done, at least in the Knox case, under the guise of an emergency situation to tide the country over financially during the Civil War. Well, let's go on a few years. Comes 1875, and Congress finally arranged for the redemption of these U.S. notes, the greenbacks. So they were now a fully redeemable currency. And the question came up again to the Supreme Court because Congress was, or the Treasury was, reissuing these things as they were brought in for redemption. The Treasury would pay them out again.
Okay.
So the question now arose, well, there's no longer a war going on. Is there any constitutional justification for the Treasury to be continuing to circulate these things? And of course, the Supreme Court, typically it does, it took the limitation, the condition that it imposed in its earlier decision, threw it out the window and said, oh, of course, this is all for Congress to decide whether it should be done or not. We don't know. What's an emergency? That's all a question for Congress to decide. So whether it's peacetime or wartime, Congress can emit these things. But note once again that these were the same U.S. notes, greenbacks, redeemable in gold and silver and emitted by whom? By the Treasury of the United States.
Yes. Now,
pursuant to a statute of Congress that said how much was to be emitted.
Right. And now, am I picking this up correctly, Edwin, that they went back to the case instead of going back to the Constitution, too, right?
That's right.
Okay.
They went back. This is typical of what they do. Once you get one of these bad precedents in the door,
right,
it has a life of its own.
Right.
and then they will revert, in later cases, will revert to that earlier precedent without going behind that precedent to ask, well, does this make sense from a constitutional perspective?
Right, and that's the argument here, folks.
That's
the bottom
line.
Right.
That's the whole problem. Now, it was quite clear that that first wedge that was driven in the Knox case, was based upon the fact that the justices, at least the five justices, and one who was really interested in the law ought to read that particular case, because there were a number of dissents, and it's all very clear which side is right. But the justices on the majority side clearly saw that these greenbacks were somehow of great importance to the winning of the Civil War by the Union forces.
Okay.
And I think you can read between the lines there, a very political decision had come across. But the principle was now in the law. Now, notice something very important, though. The principle in the law was Congress could pass a statute saying that X millions or hundreds of millions of dollars worth of governmental paper currency redeemable in silver or gold could be emitted by the Treasury. All right? That's what the Supreme Court upheld. Even that went beyond the Constitution, but that's all the Supreme Court upheld. Now, just going forward very quickly, take a look at the situation you have today. The Federal Reserve System emits whatever amount of irredeemable Federal Reserve notes it wants without the Treasury or Congress having anything to say about it. Notice the difference?
Absolutely.
All right. So there's been a tremendous leap, even from those early decisions upholding the concept of congressional paper currency, to what we have today in the Federal Reserve. Well, now, what came in between? You had in the Civil War a breakdown of the state banking system. That is, the state government also had corporations that just wanted to have during the Civil War. So Congress came along and passed in 1863, and then in 1864, redid it, what they called the National Currency Act, or the National Banking Law. And what this did was to create a set of national banks. The national banks were corporations chartered by Congress, and essentially what would happen is the bankers, the private capitalists, would come in, and they would buy United States bonds and deposit those bonds with a comptroller of the currency. And they would then be allowed to use 90% of the face value of those bonds to generate paper money to put out through those banks. So here was a banking system that was essentially designed to monetize governmental debt.
Right.
All right? So here, this is where this little fill-up or trick insinuates itself into the system. Now we have the banks tied into the government. The linkage is government debt, and the payoff is the ability of the banks to generate paper currency, which, of course, they can loan at interest and make money. So the government is floating its debt. The banks are generating paper money. They're loaning the money. They're making money. Theoretically, their customers are making money in the use of that currency. And that's the deal. Now we have a symbiotic relationship, or incestuous relationship, if you will, between the banking financial class and the political class set up through the National Banking Act.
Huge. No doubt. And, folks, check this out. And this is absolutely huge, because as we always talk, you know, you have the government, you have the corporations, you have the society. And, you know, don't ever think that, make sure that you understand that those are all separate. This is wild. Seriously.
That's right. Well, they're separate. They have separate interests.
Absolutely.
They have separate interests.
Right.
And the National Banking Act was clearly designed to bring the interests of the financial group and the interests of the politicians into some kind of parallel structure.
Right.
So they'd be looking in the same direction. Well, the difficulty with the National Banking Act was that you still had these periodic panics, financial stringencies and economic dislocations. And because the system, although it had the so between, let's say, the 1880s or so and 1913, when the Federal Reserve System finally comes in, there was a great deal of debate and discussion among the financial class people as to how to stabilize the banking system. And the theory was, well, we need what's called a lender of last resort. We need some kind of agency that can put out the necessary liquidity when the system goes into a mode of stringency. And what we also want is to have some kind of direct tie-in to the government, more effective than the comptroller of the currency, which is what they had in the National Banking Act. And so they sent out some people to Europe to study the central banking systems of Europe. And then we all know the story, many people know the story of how Senator Aldrich and Paul Warburg and a number of others, seven in all told, went down to Death Island and joined the weekend or so when they put them into a cartel with a governmental board, Federal Reserve Board, now it's called the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System, on top. And this thing would have regulatory authority to cause all of these banks to act essentially in unison. So there'd be expansion in unison and there'd be contraction in unison. You wouldn't have these, theoretically, you wouldn't have wild swings that had occurred even under the National Banking Act. You wouldn't have these periodic panics. In fact, the Federal Reserve System was touted as the scientific method for ending depressions.
Yeah, right.
Right? They were going to manage currency, elastic currency. It would expand when it had to expand. It would contract when it had to contract. It would be managed by experts in this.
Folks, every Wednesday, 4:20, okay, we're going to be getting this education going forward. Edwin has a book that's absolutely phenomenal, folks. It's Pieces of Eight. Go to our website at TFNN. Go to the radio page, contributors. You go right down there. His website is Pieces of Eight. And I got to tell you something, folks. The book is absolutely phenomenal. You get two volumes that are approximately 900 pages apiece, and the whole total is only $55. Check it out at TFNN.com, right at the contributor page. Edwin, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. You know what I can't wait to get into it? The United States notes that President Kennedy put out. You know?
Oh, yeah.
It's absolutely wild. Thank you so much for the education. Really appreciate it. Have a great week.
Take care.
Absolutely. This is Tom O'Brien, Tiger Financial News Network, and we're going to be right back, folks. Edward Vieira, Jr., author of Pieces of Eight, The Monetary Powers and Disabilities of the United States Constitution, to give us a great education on exactly how our money not only started, but exactly what our money's all about. Edward, how you doing?
Glad to be here with you again, Tom.
Glad to be back. How you been?
Oh, just fine. And you?
Good. I've been great. Had a great wedding. Had a great honeymoon.
Yeah, well, congratulations to your bride.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. So, start here. You know, we've had, and I got to tell you, I want to thank you. You know, what we did is that we made an archive, right, of the first two interviews I did.
Right.
And I took off Friday afternoon. It was dynamite. We played it for the full hour, the 5 o'clock hour. People absolutely loved it. So, it really worked out well. You know, we started out with how money was actually, you know, basically how we had real money at the beginning. And, you know, then, you know, of course, with congressional action, with Roosevelt, with the Depression, that things start changing. At this particular point, where would you like to start off?
Well, let me ask you a question,
yeah.
Tom, because you're obviously a financial markets expert as well as a general markets expert. Many people today, and I've been to conferences all over the country, you hear this story coming out of what I would call free market economists, generally speaking. They say, look, the problem with our monetary system is the legal tender laws. The legal tender laws require you to use Federal Reserve note currency or this junk-clad coinage as your medium of exchange.
Yes.
And if you didn't have those legal tender laws, people would use silver, they use gold, they use sound money, they wouldn't use fiat money that's generated at the whim of the Federal Reserve Board. Now, the point is, there is no law in this country that requires anyone to use Federal Reserve notes as his or her exclusive media of exchange. You can make what's called technically a gold clause contract. It could be a silver clause contract. It could be a peso clause contract, whatever it is. You can make a contract that specifies the medium of exchange to be used for that transaction or set of transactions to the exclusion of Federal Reserve notes. That is, you can opt out entirely from the Federal Reserve note currency system if you choose to do so. Why is it then that at the present time, and I must say those contracts were illegal from 1933 until 1977. They were illegal, but they were re-legalized by Congress in 1977. Why is it that we don't see large numbers of contracts of that kind being made, given what I think many people know of
about the instability of the Federal Reserve System. And let me go back one step further to preface this question again. After the Civil War, or with the Civil War, actually, the generation of the legal tender greenbacks.
Yes.
Gold clause contracts became a very, very popular way of protecting people against depreciation, against paper money inflation, to the extent that essentially every long-term contract in this country, whether it's for insurance, corporate bonds, United States Treasury bonds, for that matter, had a gold clause, a promise to pay principal and interest in the gold coinage of the United States. And those clauses were in existence from, let's say 1863, when they really became pretty popular, until 1933, when Congress outlawed them in the midst of the Depression with the various steps by President Roosevelt to go off the so-called gold standard.
Yes.
All right, they were very, very popular in the early days. You don't see them at all today. Is this simply a matter of ignorance?
Yeah, it is. You know, I it's a great question, and it's great getting educated like this, because I can tell when I really got my head into the gold market, which is probably around, I guess, maybe about, it's the last 2 years. You know, I was watching a couple other market timers, and I kept saying, that's not ready, and then about a year and a half ago, I jumped, right? And what had happened is that at one point, we were basically, I was selling a lot of coins also. And then I just couldn't get them enough of them anymore, so I stopped selling them, because I just, it wasn't liquid enough for me, right?
Right.
But what did happen is this. I was talking to some of the clients, right, some of the tigers out there, and what I found out, wait to hear this. Now, in the cities, okay, it is a different animal, but I had a couple clients say to me flat out, and they lived in the western states, right, and they said, hey, flat out, we're buying horses right now with gold, and if they don't like it, well, I'm not going to buy the horses off them. And it was, I said, oh, that's really wild, man. But I never realized, you know, until you just explained this now, that you can make those contracts there, and it makes total sense. And I guess the way that you could get on a system going more is that each and every one of us use something like that when you're doing purchases like that.
That's right. That's what I've often told people. I said, if enough people in this country understood first the fragility of the Federal Reserve System.
Yes.
And secondly, what their present legal rights are to protect themselves against possible, let's not call them collapses, but possible dire events connected with the Federal Reserve System. They could, at least to some extent, opt out of the system. It doesn't have to be 100%. You could make some arrangements, some contracts, some percentage of your income.
So. Absolutely.
And for protection. And those contracts would be perfectly legal, perfectly enforceable. Now, of course, one could never say that in the future, if there were a very dire event, Congress would not do the same thing that it did in 1933.
Yeah.
But in this interim period, while we're looking forward to the possibility of dangerous times coming and trying to protect ourselves to the greatest extent possible, it just strikes me as interesting, or perhaps worrisome is a better word, to see how few people realize the extent of their rights and how they could be exercised to protect them.
You know, it's a huge point you're making here. And what I've found, each and every time that when I look at the way that the system is built out, folks, okay, it's built out to redistribute wealth each and every day. And the thing that's absolutely bizarre, you know, we trade a lot, Edward, okay, but I know none of it's real, and that's what I try to explain to people. Well, they say it's manipulated. Well, if you're going to be in the market, you better understand it's manipulated day and night. I mean, that's the market, okay?
Right.
But if you understand that, well, a trade's a trade, you know, so it's like you just hope you're on the right side of it. Me and Andrew are out in California picking her mother up about 6 months ago, right? And I'm watching, and I was stationed in California when I was a kid, basically. I was 17, right? And, you know, at that point, there was traffic out there, but nothing like right now, right? And I remember looking at that traffic, and I says, you know, the folks that are running things right now, they know that they have everyone on a treadmill, because those poor people in California, they're absolutely out of their mind. I mean, they get in traffic for an hour and a half to go to work one way. It's like, okay, if they're going to do that, they're going to take anything, you know. So I mean, I think it's arrogance on the part of the elite, really, that, you know, they know that, hey, listen, we got the whole country, and we got them cold. You know?
Well, that's Washington, that's New York, that's Boston.
Yeah, absolutely.
All of the major urban centers, they've got people hooked in that sense.
Right.
And they're tied into a financial system that they don't understand. That's the most interesting part to my mind.
Yes, it is.
Given how important it is to the entire economy, obviously, we don't have to be a PhD economist to understand how important money is in a market economy. How few people understand it, and how even fewer take the time to try to understand it.
Right.
Right?
Right.
I mean, in a way, that's the thing that causes a certain level of despondency that anyone who views this the way I do, is to say, how can you run a system in the long term, a market economy based on freedom of contract, private property, representative government, so forth and so on, when the players, the main players in that system, that is the average American, the voter, who theoretically controls the government with all the effect it has on the economy, doesn't know and really doesn't care to know. That's the problem.
So now what do we do about it? Because, you know, one of the, it's a huge point, folks, that Edwin's making here, and I'd say that something that comes back in spades here is, right, you know, basically what WorldCom has just got away with. I mean, you know, you have their competitors, you know, they're suing them because they're saying, you know, it was a corrupt enterprise, and it was. I mean, you know, the bottom line is that they were worse than the mafia. They take everyone's money, they have the beautiful assets now, they have that infrastructure that's built, and they're going to let them come out of bankruptcy. I mean, that in itself is unbelievable. I mean, that just shows the system that we're living in. But it's like, okay, you know, where do we start fighting it? What is the A point, what is the B point, and what do we do?
Well, the A point, I think, is just what you're doing, Tom. The A point is to attempt as much as possible to saturate the media, whether it's the internet, whether it's radio, television is probably a lost cause right now.
Right.
But newsletters, whatever, to saturate the media with the message, not necessarily the message in all the detail that books such as mine have, or Murray Rothbard, some of the other people who have written extensively about this, but to saturate the media with the very important point that there is something fundamentally wrong here.
Right.
And people have to start educating themselves, because they will not get this in school. They will not get I mean, my book talks a lot about law.
Yes.
I spent years in law school, obviously. I spent years at practicing law. I was at a luncheon the other day in New York, sitting down with a federal district judge, and I was talking about the monetary cases of the Supreme Court and how some of the really bad principles that had been used to justify our present monetary system had seeped out from those cases into other areas of law and really were polluting the whole body of constitutional law. And the judge said to me, you know, that stuff is not taught in law schools.
Yeah.
At all.
Right.
And I said, Judge, that's the problem. And he agreed with me.
Right.
That's the problem. And it's not just a matter of law, it's a matter of economics, it's a matter of the politics that's behind this. I talk in my book, I use the phrase political banking.
Oh, absolutely.
Because that's what we have now, political banking.
There's no doubt about it. The name of the book, folks, is Pieces of Eight. You go right on our website, go to the contributor page, you'll see Edward right there, and you can take a quick credit over to his site. Oh, there's no doubt about that. And just so, you know, I can back up for a second. Folks, you know, there is a lot of law in this book, but I can tell you, if you are into history, it is absolutely phenomenal. I mean, it's two books, okay? The thing it's 1,600 to 1,700 pages, folks. And it's the deal of a lifetime. I'm not kidding. But the history in it is absolutely phenomenal. You know what is wild here is that I think also if we can get to the public and let them really understand that they're stealing their money every day. I mean, that's what they're really doing. And you know, I can tell you, I've been in the finance business for forever, really, all my life. Okay. But I I'd always hear the quote, okay, redistribution of wealth, okay, and I watched basically the Japanese come into downtown Boston, buy it up, they lost it. The Middle East, they bought it up, they lost it, right? And, you know, and I used to say this all. And your folks, it's coming out of your pocket. It's coming out of your pocket. First time I ever heard Edwin, the honest money, I really didn't know what it meant. I just, what are you talking about? Oh, look, I'm looking at the Federal Reserve and it says, in God we trust, doesn't it? I mean, you know, in fact, well, it doesn't say it anymore.
But we better trust in God because there's nobody else we can trust in that.
Yeah, exactly.
Look, this is like playing cards, Tom.
Right.
And some people are better card players than others. Some people sit down at that poker table and they're going to lose every hand, right?
Yeah.
But the game is no good if the deck is stacked.
Right.
It's one thing to say that some players are better than others. It's another thing even to say that somebody shouldn't be playing cards because he's so bad. But nobody can tolerate a stacked deck except the man who's dealing it. Right?
Right.
And essentially that's what we have in this system. We have a system of political banking, political money, and a certain class in society is dealing those cards, and everyone else is anteing up and losing more hands than we're winning.
On a continual basis. Absolutely.
On a continual basis, and of course, that in the long run, that shifts tremendous amounts of wealth. They don't have to make much on each hand. They don't have to make a large percentage.
Yes.
But if enough hands are being played, and you know the trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars worth of transactions that take place in the world every day.
Absolutely.
And if they're getting a small rake off on each one of those, how much real wealth is being transferred, and then on top of that, how much real political power that wealth can buy.
And folks, that is the key right there, because what happens on a continual basis, that's where the soft money is, that's where everything is. It goes into the politician has to make the law. The last thing they're going to do is flip on the other side of that and give us a break, because
right.
It's as sick as you get. You know, can I just back up for one second? I'm looking on my wall here. You know, when Kennedy came in, right?
Right.
And he made that United States note, right? What was that? 1962,
right?
Okay. What made him do that, and how they stop it? I mean, you know, there's a million conspiracies out there. Yeah, he made the note that all of a sudden he gets bumped off, right? I mean,
well, I think a lot of people may be making more of that than it's worth, because
okay.
That provision of the law actually came in 1933.
I see.
There was a provision called the Thomas Amendment that was put in for the purpose of giving the executive branch, the president, the secretary of the treasury, the ability to generate at that time $300 million worth of U.S. treasury notes.
Okay.
If the Federal Reserve did not expand the monetary supply sufficiently,
it
kind of tied it together. But it was still it was sitting there.
Okay.
And so it could have been used under circumstances in which the Fed wanted to maintain stringency.
Right.
Now, the thing about Kennedy that makes me a little ambivalent is that he's the same person, same president, who went along with the program of the Federal Reserve to begin the removal of silver from the domestic monetary system.
Oh, wow.
So he's the man that himself had removed gold. International payments. Kennedy comes in 62 and 63, and he goes along with the program to remove silver, which was the last step in creating fiat currency.
Unbelievable. Listen, Edward, thank you so much. Next Wednesday, folks, same time, we're going to get into our money system. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it. Have a great one. This is Tom O'Brien. We're going to be right back, folks.